Hi, everybody. My name is Kat, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here. I want to thank Craig for asking us to come. This is really a great conference. It's a lot of fun. We're having a lot of fun. I apologize to the people who were just in the workshop 20 minutes ago. It's really more of this girl than you thought you were going to see this morning. Did I just call myself a girl? Woman? I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love living my life the way I live it today. I can't believe, we were talking in the workshop about miracles that happen here, and this room is full of them. You know, it's hard, when you look at my life, you can't get from there to here, you know, and yet here I am. If you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that you stay here. I hope that you find what I have found and other people in this room have found. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me. I believe I was born an alcoholic, but it doesn't really matter. I say that because I drank alcoholically from the gate. I didn't think I was drinking alcoholically. I thought I was drinking socially, I suppose because I was drinking with other people, you know, but I was not. My first drunk was when I was 13 years old. I was at a party. People were drinking, and so I drank. And I didn't have any feelings one way or the other, should I drink, should I not drink. I just, they offered it, so I drank. I've always felt like I didn't quite fit in. I've always felt, I describe myself as being incredibly shy. In Alcoholics Anonymous, you call things by different names. You call that one self-obsession. I like shy better. Shy implies I can't help it. It's not really my fault, you know. But self-obsession is what it is. I think about me all the time. How do I look? How do I sound? How do I feel? What are you thinking about me? So I'm at this party. I'm feeling all of that, and somebody handed me a rum and coke, and my life changed. I drank that rum and coke, and I don't know, maybe another one. When you're 13, you never drank before. I don't think it takes too much to get drunk. But however much it took, I drank that much and then some, and that's how I drank until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. The magic happened for me that night, which is for me that I completely relaxed at that party. Completely. Just felt totally comfortable, talked to people without trouble, said funny things that made people laugh, got up and danced and felt like the best dancer there. It was magical. Now, as I said, I drank a little too much there. I blacked out. I passed out. And I woke up in bed the next morning with a Marine that I didn't know, which is kind of more than I meant to do. You know, I was a nice girl from Newport Beach, and the girls in my crowd were not behaving this way, and I felt bad that next day. I felt, ashamed and embarrassed. I was terrified that I'd get pregnant. Imagine the bad feelings a 13-year-old might have under that set of circumstances, and I had all of those bad feelings. And yet, I drank again at the very next possible opportunity without a second thought. I was apparently willing to pay the price for drinking from the gate. I say apparently because, again, I didn't think any of this through. If it sounds like I have great insight into my life, believe me, I didn't have it when I was living it. You know, I got it long after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, for a while I was a periodic, mostly because I was 13, 14, 15 years old. I didn't have access to alcohol every day, but I sure drank it every time the opportunity presented. Mostly that was on weekends at beach parties. Mostly it was beer. Because that's what we could get as minors. Up until the time I got drunk that first time, I was a straight A student. I went to church every Sunday. I was very involved in a church youth group, and I did all of those things because I wanted to do those things. I meant to be a person who would grow up and get married and stay married to the same person forever, and maybe have some kids and go to church and PTA and work in the garden on weekends. I mean, I really meant to live like a regular life. But I'm 13, 14, 15 years old, and I'm drinking at every opportunity. And when I drink, I get, shall we say, friendly. And so I developed this reputation in high school for being a friendly girl. And, I kind of sensed right then that life that I sort of had pictured wasn't going to happen for me, you know. My grades dropped right away. I was getting C's and D's. I quit going to church, and my parents were very concerned about me. They sent me away to boarding school an all-girls boarding school for my last couple of years of high school, hoping to, at least get me graduated successfully. And it had the desired effect. It was a very structured school. It was a school kind of like the last stop before reform school. I don't even know if they have reform schools anymore. Maybe I have to be old to know what that was. But it was a very, very structured environment. It was very difficult to get alcohol there. And so I studied. I think alcoholics, when they're applying themselves to whether it be work or school or whatever, actually work harder than anybody else. The problem, obviously, is that we don't apply ourselves all that often. But because I was in such a structured environment and wasn't drinking there, I studied hard. I brought my grades up. I graduated successfully. I got in trouble there, but not too much because it was hard to get in trouble there, actually. So I graduated from high school, and I moved back in with my folks, and I went to a local junior college, and it was pretty much a party school, and I was right in there with the best of them. And I met the man who was to become my first husband at a dance. The Rendezvous Ballroom in Newport Beach was the place to go when I was growing up. Surfing music was the, totally dated myself with that one, it was the big thing at the time. Dick Dale and the Deltones. So I see you're nodding your head over there. So I met the boy who was to become my first husband there. Now, we met in the ballroom. There's music, of course, blaring all the time. Our dating life consisted of he would pick me up at my parents' house. We would go to the liquor store that would sell to minors out the back door, buy beer, sit in the car on the bluffs in Newport, drink our beer, go into the ballroom. They didn't sell alcohol inside, so you get your hands stamped and keep going out to the car, you know, and drink more. And so we've never really, you know, that was our courtship. That was it. When he asked me to marry him, I remember thinking, this is great. We have so much in common. I think we never really had a conversation. So now we're planning this big wedding, big church wedding, and I had these little doubts sort of in the back of my mind. I read a lot of books, and in books, brides-to-be feel things that I did not seem to be feeling. And I kind of worried a little bit about that, but I, of course, did not discuss this with anybody. And so the day came closer, and I remember walking down the aisle on my dad's arm thinking, this is probably a mistake. Now, I know that's not what you're supposed to be thinking when you're walking down the aisle, but it's like I was somebody else watching me. I just marched down there and said I do, and so now we're married. Now, you know, when we were dating, he lived at home with his parents, I lived at home with my parents, so the money that we had from our little jobs that we had was spent on drinking and partying. Now we're married, and we have rent and all that kind of stuff, and we had no money for drinking. And in retrospect, I was restless, irritable, and discontent, and needed to drink real bad. Again, I didn't know that at the time. We were married for about 5 months, and I had one brother growing up who was 3 years older than me, and my brother was very badly injured he was in the Navy, he was very badly injured in an accident on board his ship. His ship was in Japan at the time, so they took him off the ship and put him in a hospital in Japan, and the ship sailed. And so now my brother's in a foreign country where he doesn't speak the language, he has nobody there that he knows, and he's very badly injured. So I started sending him cards every day, sometimes several cards a day, trying to cheer him up. And, you know, I spent a lot of time in the card shops looking for funny cards. And about a month went by, and my mother was getting telegrams from whoever, the Navy Department, I don't know, whoever sends these telegrams. And after about a month, she got a telegram saying that his condition had improved enough that they thought they were going to be able to ship him back to the States, that he still had a long recovery ahead of him, but they thought he would be well enough to come back. And we were very happy, celebrated that news, because it meant that he would be in the Naval Hospital in San Diego, so we'd be able to see him. And so we're very excited about that. Right around the time we heard that news, I had sent another of these many cards I'd been sending that month. The card was intended to be funny. On the front, it said, heard you were ailing, but not to worry. On the inside, it said, only the good die young. I sent it, and he died. And, you know, I don't think I could have felt worse if I'd killed him myself. I couldn't believe I'd sent such a stupid card. I just couldn't believe I'd been that stupid. My prayer was that the card didn't get there in time. My prayer was that he died before that stupid, insensitive card arrived. It took, a couple of weeks for his belongings to be shipped back to my mother. And I remember her opening the trunk that day. That card was in there. It had been opened. And I took it when nobody was looking. I went in the bathroom and I tore it up in little pieces and flushed it down the toilet and cried and cried and cried. I tell you that story because that happened when I was 19 years old. I got sober when I was 30. I never told it to anybody until I did an inventory in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I couldn't. I just couldn't. I felt so terrible about that card. And that's how I lived my life. Putting more secrets on top of other secrets that were already there. I couldn't talk to anybody about anything that really mattered. My mother, somewhere in from that time, between that time and the time I got sober, sent me to a psychiatrist. She said to me one day, if I paid for it, would you go? And I said, yes. I, by then, knew that there was something terribly wrong with me. I didn't know I was enough. I remember saying to somebody once, I thought I was a potential alcoholic, whatever that may be. But I knew there was something real wrong with me, and so when she offered to send me to a psychiatrist, I agreed, and I didn't have a cavalier attitude about it. I really saw it as an opportunity to get some help. But I sat in this guy's office, and I liked the guy. He was really warm and caring, and I felt like we kind of connected, but I couldn't tell him the truth. I couldn't tell him anything that really mattered. I never told him about that card and my brother. I never told him about the stuff that was going on in my house when I was growing up with my stepfather, because I couldn't. I simply couldn't. And so I sat in his office every week talking about sort of nothing, and then I would leave and I would feel worse than when I got there. And I would go, I remember he was on Sunset Boulevard, there was a little bar right around the corner. I would walk to that little bar and have a drink, and then I could drive home. So I completely and totally wasted my mother's money. I have nothing against psychiatry, but I think it's kind of wasted on practicing alcoholics, because we're incapable of telling the truth, you know. Certainly I was. So now my brother has died. I cannot get a grip on my grief and my guilt, and so I'm crying all the time. And my husband said to me, I don't know, after, I don't know, a couple of weeks or something, he said, I don't know how to help you get over the grief of your brother's death. Maybe you should go stay with your mother, with your parents for a while. Maybe she could help you get through this. And I said, okay. And I went back to my parents' house, and I never lived another day with that husband. Now, he didn't quite know what had happened there. He was trying to help me. And now I'm gone, and I'm not coming back. And I remember he called and wrote and offered to go to marriage counseling, and I couldn't even talk to him, because I just knew I couldn't go back there. And so I divorced him. Now, clearly, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and took a look at these steps, this is clearly somebody to whom I owed amends. I didn't see him. I divorced him. I guess I was 19 when I divorced him. As I said, I got sober when I was 30. I didn't see him in all those years. I was sober about 6 months, and I ran into him. And I thought, wow, this is pretty incredible. Here I am sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and God drops this guy right in my path. Here's an opportunity to make amends. Then my next thought was, I'm not sober all that long, and I'm not actually to that step yet. And I let the opportunity pass by. That was 31 and a half years ago, and I haven't seen him from that day to this. I always like to tell that story when I talk. It's my hearty recommendation that when opportunities to make amends present themselves, you do it. I sure wish I'd done that one. I hope God gives me another shot at it. I've made some attempts to find him over the years, and I just can assure you I remain ready, willing, and able to do that. Anyway, so I got divorced and moved up to L.A., which was about an hour's drive away from Newport, and I got a job in an apartment. I'm 19 years old. I have an ID that says I'm 35 or something, and I look about 12, you know. And my first job was at a trucking company in L.A. As a secretary. My parents had been divorced when I was young. My real father was vice president of this company. I had very good secretarial skills, but when you're young and you've not had a job, it's hard to get that first job. So I asked my dad if he would hire me. And I remember him saying, oh gosh, I don't know, honey. I'm a little reluctant to hire a family member. But I begged, and so he reluctantly agreed to hire me for a year. And I was grateful. It was a good opportunity. It would be a good solid year to have on a resume. It would give me a foot into the working world. And so I went to work for this trucking company. There was a problem. My dad should have listened to his instincts, because I behaved at that trucking company pretty much the way I'd behaved in high school, which is to say, before that job was over, I had known most of those drivers in the biblical sense. As you might well imagine, this caused my father some anguish. And embarrassed. He called me one day. I'd been there about eight or 9 months maybe, and he called me and tried to talk to me about me. Now, I don't know about you, but I can't talk about me. You know, if I look at any of this too closely, I'm going to have to admit there's a problem, and I'm nowhere near ready to do that. And so I said some kind of ugly things to my dad on the phone that day, and the upshot of that conversation was that I didn't speak to him again for many years, except when absolutely necessary at weddings and funerals and that sort of thing, until I got sober and was able to make amends to him. Anyway, I actually left the job before the year was up because it just got too uncomfortable there. And then I began, my whole career was jobs of less than a year, because I get the job and when I'm new on the job, I'm a little nervous, so I keep my drinking separate for a while. You know, my drinking is not involved with this job until I get comfortable on the job, which is a month or two, and I know they're pleased with me. I'm a very good secretary, so they're happy with me. And then I sort of relax about how I'm acting and where I'm drinking and who I'm drinking with. And now I'm drinking sometimes at lunchtime, and I'm always going out for work or after work with my coworkers and drinking with my coworkers and the boss and the clients and sleeping with half of them or their spouses. Matters not to me. And so, of course, I create a big ugly mess here, and I have to leave, and I go on to the next job. And I convinced myself, every job I ever left, I convinced myself I had perfectly good reasons for, I did have good reasons, but perfectly good other reasons for leaving. If I was at a big corporation, I would convince myself that a smaller company would be probably better for my particular talents. If I was at a little company, I think a big corporate atmosphere might be better. And I believed it every time because I needed to believe it. I have quit jobs after office Christmas parties without going back to clean out my desk because I've known I couldn't face those people in the light of day. I drank a lot in blackouts, and frankly, I'm grateful for it. I remember plenty. I don't need more information. Here's how I drank. I went out with my boss and coworkers. Went out with my boss and coworkers one night after work. We were bar hopping around downtown LA. We were all drunk. I was not the only person who was drunk that night, but evidently I was a little bit drunker than the rest of them, because when we wound up in the strip joint, I was the only one who auditioned for a job. Now, I know if you're an alcoholic and you're sitting in this room, you know how this happened. It really wasn't my fault. I mean, the stage was like here, and we were sitting at a round table directly in front of the stage. There were about maybe 8 or 10 of us in our group. I had excused myself from the table to use the ladies' room, which was down the hall, kind of behind the stage, and bumped into the owner of the bar there in the hallway, and have this vague memory of making some derogatory remarks about the caliber of his entertainment out there. And you know how this went. He said something like, if I thought I was such hot stuff, which apparently I did. So, now remember, a moment ago I'm sitting at this table with my boss and my coworkers, and I'm dressed essentially as I am dressed now. And now, moments later, I'm on the stage dressed in essentially nothing. And there was that moment when my boss's eye and mine met, that when he realized who that was up there, I will never forget the look in his face. Never. Never. It's probably a moment he won't likely forget either. Sure. This actually began what I like to refer to as my show business career. Now, when I came to the next day and I realized what I'd done, I was a little bit embarrassed. I mean, nice girls from Newport Beach do not work as strippers. I was kind of appalled at what I had done. But it kind of gave me an idea. I thought I had some talent there, and I... Go-go dancing was kind of at the height of popularity in L.A., and all the nice clubs on Sunset Strip had go-go dancers, and so I went and got a job as a go-go dancer. I did not work in the nice clubs on Sunset Strip. My first paid job as a dancer was on Whittier Boulevard in East Los Angeles. I never met anybody in there who spoke English. I'm not even sure how I got the job, to tell you the truth, how I negotiated that, but whatever. I moved uptown from there, as I saw it, to a place that was on the outskirts of Chinatown in Los Angeles. I saw it as a career move, upward move, because they spoke English there. I might add, though, that the outskirts of Chinatown is also the outskirts of Skid Row. They sort of come together there. So I met the man who has become my second husband there at Nick's, where I was working, and he was... possibly the most unsuitable man in the state of California for me. And so, of course, we set up housekeeping together right away and eventually got married. We got married. Now, this wedding was a little bit different than that first big church wedding. We got married in Vegas. I understand there's lovely chapels in Vegas where you can get married. I have no personal experience with that. We got married in the courthouse on a Sunday what they do, or what they did then anyway, is you go and you fill out your paperwork, and then they said, we wait, because it's a Sunday, we wait until we have about 30 or so couples accumulated, and then we call the judge, and he comes over, and he'll, you know, marry you. So you can either go wait in this courtroom that we have open for the couples, or you can leave and come back in an hour or so. And so first we went into the courtroom, and we sat down with these other couples, and we sat there a while, and we're looking around at these other people, and we're talking about them. God, look at these pathetic people. This is so sad. I mean, these are like really the dregs of, never dawning on us that there we were, you know. I'm sure those people were saying the same thing about us, you know. Look at that sad couple over there. So then we thought a cocktail would be nice. Now, In Vegas, you can get a cocktail anywhere. I mean, you walk in any casino, they're just handing them to you. We went to a liquor store, bought a pint, sat in the car and drank it, and then went back up to the courthouse and got married by this judge who actually was wearing his bedroom slippers at the time. Not so romantic. Now, we're married, but I'm still behaving like I'm single. And I don't mean to do this. I don't mean to be a wife who cheats on her husband, but this is how I live. I don't know how this happened to me. I never meant to be this kind of a woman, but there it is. I am this kind of a woman. And so we had a lot of trouble in our marriage, a lot of trouble. excuse me. You know, we drank in the bars in a fair amount. He was a drinker. As I said, I would never have married anybody who didn't drink. But now my drinking, not so much my drinking, my behavior behind drinking got to be this big topic of conversation around our house, and things were tense. He was a gambler, so he was gone a lot at night at the racetrack, which was actually just fine with me. Then I could just drink and not worry about how long the drink should last or, you know, what color it was. You know, I know that if it's too dark, it looks like you're drinking too much. If you drink it too fast, you drink it. I mean, I know all that, but I don't know how to mix a proper drink. I don't know how to make a drink. I still, to this day, drink a glass of milk down. I mean, that's how I drink, you know. Nothing much has changed there. So it was just, it felt like a lot of work when he was home. So when he went to the track, I was just a happy camper. He'd go off the track. I'd settle into my chair and my purple flannel bathrobe in the living room, and I would just put the bottle of scotch on the table beside me. I did use a glass. I'm not like some common drunk, but didn't bother with ice and water and all that other stuff, you know. Scotch, by the way, is my drink of choice, but I will and have drunk just about anything. My husband was a chef in a restaurant, and at Christmas time, vendors would give him gifts of booze, you know, and he'd bring it home. And I remember one year they brought him this bottle of brandy, and we had a friend, Eddie, who in retrospect was definitely an alcoholic. And Eddie came over that night, and whenever he came over, you know, we all drank together, and he came over that night, and we opened this bottle of brandy, and we all drank it, and Eddie called the next day, and he said, oh my God, that is the worst stuff I have ever drank. I was up all night sick with raging diarrhea. It was horrible. Now, it did the same thing to me, but I started buying that stuff because I knew when Eddie came over, he wouldn't drink it. Now, I don't think that's social drinking, you know? Anyway, as I said, scotch was my drink of choice. So I'd settle in there in my bathrobe, and I would play those sad records over and over again. I was personally very fond of Ray Charles' Born to Lose. That's a wonderful drink and feel sorry for yourself kind of song, you know. And sometimes I'd get the idea to call people on the phone. If you've done it, or if you're an Al-Anon and you've received the call, you know that the notion to do this never comes at 7:30 in the evening, you know. 2 in the morning, and I've heard speakers say they call the White House and demand to speak to the president. I would never do anything like that. I call people like boyfriends I had when I was 12. You know, I wonder what Danny's doing these days. And of course, I have no idea where Danny and his wife might be living. But I wake up 30 other people in my quest to find them, and I'm sure they were just thrilled to hear from me when I finally did catch up to them. My mother, in the end, was the only one still taking my calls. My mother, God bless her, has always loved me, despite how I was living my life. And she would take these terrible, drunken, middle-of-the-night phone calls and try to say something that might comfort me or calm me, or not knowing that there's really nothing much you can say to an alcoholic in that state of mind and body that's going to help all that much. But she would take those calls. I'll tell you what, if I Didn't get anything more out of Alcoholics Anonymous but sobriety and the fact that I don't torment my mother anymore like that. You know, I'm overpaid, and believe me, she's grateful. I remember one hot summer day sitting in my apartment. It was for some reason, I remember it was 10 in the morning. It was very hot. I was wearing that purple flannel bathrobe. I was drunk. I was sweating buckets. I was watching the neighbors. We lived in a second floor apartment. You could see into their backyard from the window by where I sat. And they were a young couple about my age, late 20s at the time. They had a couple small children, and the kids were running back and forth in the sprinklers on the lawn, and the parents were sitting on the back porch steps talking and drinking coffee or something and just talking and laughing and watching their kids play. And I cried that day watching those people, because that's how I meant to be living my life. I never, ever meant to be living the way I'm living here. And I knew that day beyond a shadow of a doubt, if God somehow swooped in there and handed me that life of those people next door, that I couldn't do it. I knew it. Because I had been by then, been trying not to drink on my own, and I couldn't not drink. I tried every day. As I got a little older there, I wasn't bouncing back quite so fast in the mornings. Starting to suffer these really terrible hangovers, and so I'd wake up and I'd be filled with firm resolve, I'm not drinking today. And I'd get dressed and get ready to go to work. I've always had a job. Everybody knows alcoholics don't have jobs. See, I'm thinking about this stuff now. I might add, it wasn't much of a job. I peaked in my career when I was about 23, and then it kind of went downhill. My last job, I was a legal secretary when I was 23. My last job before I got sober, I was a clerk in a YMCA. My job was, if you were a member of that Y and you came in to pay your dues, I'm the one who wrote you the receipt. I was barely hanging on to that job by the skin of my teeth, barely hanging on to it. Anyway, I would get up and I'd be, I'm not drinking today, and I'd take a shower and I'd get in the car to drive to work, and I'd think, not only am I not going to drink, but I'm going to go back to college and finish my education. And I'd pull into that YMCA parking lot and I'd think, I'm going to take some of these classes here at this Y and get physically fit. I mean, it's really going to be great. It's going to be a whole new me. It's going to be fabulous. But I'm an alcoholic. You know, before the day's out, I'm drinking. Often it's as simple as this. I get home after work, assuming I got through lunchtime without drinking, which is a 50-50 shot. I'd get home after work, and it might be an open bottle of scotch sitting on the kitchen sink, and I don't know about you, but I can't quit with an open bottle sitting here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to drink this down. Tomorrow there'll be nothing in the house, and then I'll quit. And I meant it. It made perfect sense to me. Only in AA do people nod their heads when you say such a thing. The problem, of course, with this theory is as the level of that bottle goes down, I get a little nervous, and I'm calling the liquor store to deliver a new one, and tomorrow what I have is more or less a half a fifth of scotch again. I did that day after day after day. In the end, what I would do is when I got off of work, I'd come home, and as I put my purse on the table by the door, I would write the check to the liquor store. And that's one of those things I did without thinking too strongly about. It's always the same amount. The bottle of scotch, two packs of cigarettes, a tip for the delivery guy. It's the same amount every night. And so I would write that check out. And the reason I did that then when I got home is by now, by the time I finish whatever's in the house and call, and by the time they get there, I'm sometimes too drunk to write the check. So again, that's just something I did without trying to really think about why I was doing it. I was such a good customer of bottle and keg liquor that occasionally, if it was a Saturday night or something when they were really busy, by the time I called and they got over there, I might already be passed out. And they'd knock on the door, I'd be passed out. They would actually leave the bag on my porch because they knew that I would come down the next day and pay them. And I always did. During those last couple of years, I often had my utilities turned off. I never paid any bill on time. I paid late payments on everything. But I never, ever bounced a check at Bottle and Keg Liquor. One night I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I was drunk when I called. I don't know what triggered the idea that particular night to call AA, but I called, and a real nice man answered the phone and asked me if I was having a problem with alcohol. I said that I was, and I started to cry, and he stayed on the phone with me a long time and talked to me. He told me a lot about himself, way more than I was interested in. But he was talking to me, and people weren't by now. And he told me where a meeting was the next night. He said, don't take a drink tomorrow and go to this meeting tomorrow night at 8:30. And I said, okay. Now, I doubt very much that I can not drink tomorrow. I drink every day now, but okay, yes is the right answer. So, we hung up, and I continued to drink, of course, until I passed out. I came to the next morning, and I remembered making the call, And I remembered, I found the little piece of paper where I'd written the address of the meeting place down. In the light of day, I thought I'd been a little premature. I was pretty sure that 30 was too young to be an alcoholic. And I just thought I'd, you know, overreacted. But I heard myself say to my husband at the dinner table that night, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't much care. We were not getting along at all. He went off to the track, and I went off to my first meeting of AA, and I had no idea that my life was about to change. It was a speaker meeting. There were maybe 300 people there. I remember parking my car and thinking, there is no way, because they were like you all, you know, they were walking down these church steps and they're all laughing and talking and kissing and hugging. I thought, there's no way I can get out of this car and go down there, but somehow I did. There was a man standing at the door who said, hello, my name is Clint. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I think that's the most important thing anybody ever does in a meeting. It made me feel welcome. It really did. Who knew that he was to become my dear friend? You know, he was just some guy at the door. And I went in the room. It's an 8:30 meeting, so of course I got there at 8:28. And I went in the back of the room. I remember there were pillars, big, thick pillars around the room. And so I stood behind one of these pillars. And now I'm sick. I'm shaking. I need a drink. I didn't drink that day. The guy on the phone said, don't drink, so I didn't drink. But I needed a drink badly. Sometimes by 8:30, I'm already passed out. I needed a drink bad that night. So I'm sick, I'm shaking, I'm dressed in terrible clothes, I'm sweating buckets, which was the sort of side effect of drinking that I had. And a man came up and asked me if I was new. And I thought, how in the world did he know that, with all these people in this room? And I acknowledged that I was, and it seemed like that. There's about 50 women coming at me, and they're all writing their numbers on little scraps of paper, and seemed excited to see me, and they found me a seat, and the meeting began. It was a speaker meeting. A man by the name of Norm Alpe spoke that night. And I noticed the taper has tapes of, I'm not really hawking tapes here, but he was a wonderful speaker. He talked really fast. The joke about him was he could give a two-hour talk in 40 minutes flat. And so I found myself sitting in the back of the room leaning forward so I wouldn't miss anything that that guy said, because I heard him. We actually drank in one of the same places many years apart. He was a much older man than I, but another thing that happened that night that I really got is that he said something that made me laugh, really laugh, like totally laugh, and I couldn't remember having laughed that hard ever. And of course, I was laughing laughter of identification. Again, I didn't know any of this at the time. The minute the meeting was over and we said the Lord's Prayer and these people dropped my hands, I was out the door. There is no way I can hang around and fellowship with you. Stark raving sober like this. And so I went home, but I did get the big book that night. I went home and I sat up most of the night reading it, and I remember thinking, this is great. I'm going to go to that meeting every Saturday night and be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard you say go to a lot of meetings, and I thought every Saturday night sounded like a lot. I drank again on Friday. Now, on the one hand, Saturday to Friday, I didn't drink. 6 days in a row, I didn't drink. And I'll tell you, I was impressed. I remember every day thinking, this AA thing really works. But on Friday, I was drunk. And I couldn't believe it. I'm in AA. I can't be drunk. Well, I was not exactly in AA. And I was, in fact, drunk. And so I went back to the meeting Saturday night. I raised my hand for being under a week of sobriety. I got some more phone numbers. And one of these ladies suggested I actually might want to call one of you, which, of course, I hadn't done. I drank a couple more times that week, and I called that woman who said that to me, and I was drunk, actually, when I called her, and she said, you might want to get a sponsor. You don't seem to be doing too well on your own, and most of us have found sponsors to be pretty helpful, and I had no clue what a sponsor was, which is probably just as well. Had I known, I would never have asked. She seemed to think it was important, though, so I said, well, how would one do that? And she said, well, I'll be your interim sponsor, you know, give you a chance to meet some people, and she said, meet me, and she seemed quite excited about this, too. And she said, meet me tomorrow night, bring your big book, and we'll talk about it. Now, tomorrow night was a Thursday. That's not meeting night, but I kind of sensed that I ought not to point that out to her. And so I went down and met her at the meeting, and you know, before the meeting started. And the first thing she did is she took my big book and she opened it to the front cover and told me to write that day's date in there. I wrote that date in there. She said, that is your sobriety date. I thought, I shouldn't have done this in ink. I don't think this is my sobriety. Yeah, there is nothing to indicate this might be. I'm very happy to report that's my sobriety date, August 28th, 1975. The next thing she did is she took the meeting directory and she circled the meeting for every night of the week. She didn't suggest that I go to a meeting every night. She didn't recommend that I go to a meeting every night. She said, on Monday night you'll go here, Tuesday night there, Wednesday night I'll go over here. I said, excuse me, I'm a married woman. I cannot possibly do this. I cannot possibly go to a meeting every night. And she said, well, perhaps you could do it on less, but not with me as your sponsor. She said something like, if you want me to be your sponsor, I assume it's because you want what I have. And if you want what I have, I only know one way to get it, and that's to do what I do. There's no arguing this one. You know, I mean, there's just no way around that. I found, for me, I believe the miracle happened in that next second because I found myself agreeing to do what she said. If you're new, it's important to know that I didn't agree happily, and I didn't do it happily, but I did it. If attitude mattered, you would have a different speaker today, and it'd be a much smaller meeting. I can guarantee you that. I was sort of famous in my group for crying. My sponsor told me I had to get to every meeting 1 hour early, 60 minutes early, not 55 minutes early, 60 minutes early. I was to have early commitments like the cookies or setting up chairs or coffee or something. I was to get there 60 minutes early and do my commitment, and then when I finished doing whatever it was, wander throughout the room and shake hands with other people as they got there, introduce myself, and get at least 3 phone numbers of women that I didn't already have. And then the next day following the meeting, in addition to calling my sponsor, I was to call these 3 women whose numbers I had gotten the night before. Now, I'm having enough trouble calling her. I can't even imagine calling, essentially, a total stranger. I couldn't imagine what I would say. I mean, I always thought that you wouldn't know who I was when I called, and I thought I was going to have to go through this like big explanation of who I was. I could have just said, hi, I'm Pat, the girl who cried for the entire meeting last night, and I'm sure you would have remembered me, because that's what I did. I never thought of doing that. So I would sit by the phone. I was so nervous about making these calls. I would sit by the phone, and I would just be sweating, thinking about it, and I'd kind of gear up my nerve, and I'd dial my first number, and I'd take a giant breath in. You'd answer, and in one giant exhale, I'd say something like, hi, my name is Pat. I have long brown hair and glasses. I met you at the meeting last night. I'm new. My sponsor told me I had to call 3 people every day, and you're one of them, so how are you anyway? I don't even know if they ever understood a word I said, but they all seemed to get that I was new. And everybody was kind to me. I don't ever remember hanging up from one of those phone calls feeling bad. Or I especially was grateful to, there were actually people who could make me laugh. My friend, dear friend Marianne Kay, to this day, I believe our friendship started in one of those early phone calls because I called her and she made me laugh out loud. She said something so funny. And believe me, I was not laughing much in those days. And so it went. I never got particularly comfortable making these calls. I never really saw the point. I'll tell you the point. I think of sponsor direction as having this sort of ripple effect. You know, you do something, you get a direction when you're new or not so new, whenever you get it, and you incorporate that action into your life. Somewhere down that, you know, the results from that action are going to come somewhere down the road that you can't even possibly see yet, that your sponsor can't even see, really. And that was true with those phone calls. When I was 3 years sober, I guess, 3 years sober, my husband was dying of cancer. I've just skipped over a huge big part of my story, but we actually talked about it a lot in the workshop, so too bad if you missed it. But I had by then made amends to my husband. We you know, our marriage was in a completely different place. But he was sick with cancer. He was in the hospital. He'd been sick for about a year, and a hard year, no question about it. And I was at the hospital one day, and it was just a bad day for me. You know, it's not that I wanted to drink, but I just remember thinking, I can't do this anymore. I can't be strong. I can't be at this hospital. I just can't do it anymore. I just kind of wanted to run away from my life, I guess would be a way of expressing it. And the thought ran through my head that it would probably be a good idea to call my sponsor. And so there was a payphone in the intensive care waiting room. And I stepped in that payphone and I called my sponsor and she wasn't home. This was long before voicemail was invented. I didn't even know anybody who had an answer machine. I mean, nobody did. And, you know, the phone just rang and rang, and eventually I hung up and the dime came back. And without even thinking about it, I put it back in the phone. I carry a little phone book with AA phone numbers in it, and I called somebody else. I called 11 people that day before I reached somebody who was home. That's why my sponsor had me calling 3 people every day. So when the day came, as it will come for everyone, when I absolutely needed to reach out to another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, the habit of doing that would be so much a part of me that I would just do it without really thinking about it, and that is what happened. And, you know, that's something that thing about those phone calls still to this very day stands me in good stead. 4 years ago, when Vince had colon cancer. He was in the City of Hope, and he'd been there, I don't know, 3 weeks at that time in intensive care, and I was so scared. I mean, I really thought he was going to die, and I was having another one of those kind of days where I just thought, I cannot do this anymore. And I went out in the courtyard where my cell phone would work. You see the progression of time here. And I called my friend Rita, and her voicemail picked up, and I said, "Hi, it's Pat Yo," and then I burst into tears. If I hadn't identified myself, I would have just hung up. But now I've identified myself, so I feel obliged to try to leave some kind of a message. But I could not get a grip. I simply could not stop crying. I just sobbed into the phone. I finally just hung up. It was useless to keep trying. I hung up. I went back in the hospital room with Vince, and about 10 or 15 minutes later, I thought, I really need to call Rita back and let her know I haven't jumped off the cliff or something. And so I went back outside and I called back. I got her voicemail and I said, please disregard my prior message. I'm feeling ever so much better. The point of this story is it didn't matter that she wasn't home. What mattered is that I picked up the phone and made the call and reached out to another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Rita wasn't going to have any magical answer there for me that day, you know. She can't cure cancer, or, you know what I'm saying? But the thing for me is to remember who I am, that I'm an alcoholic and I can't do any of this on my own. I simply can't do any of it on my own. To go back, where am I going back to? with my late husband. When he passed away, I went down to this little chapel and I made some funeral arrangements, and a couple hundred people from Alcoholics Anonymous took the day off from work to be there. They did not know him. But they came that day for me, and that's what we do. That's what we do here. Vince and I started, now it didn't happen quite this fast, but it happened faster than my parents thought was seemly. Vince and I started dating after my husband passed away, and this is the first time I ever dated a friend. Every relationship I've ever had up until Vince was, I meet a man, we go to bed, and then maybe we embark on a relationship. Vince had been my friend in Alcoholics Anonymous for 3.5 years, and so we started dating, and we fell in love, and we got married, and we have a really great life. I mean, we really have a great life. I can't believe that I live the way I live. I can't believe that I am married to the same person all these years, almost 27 years we're married. I'm never in it for the long haul. I'm a kind of a sprinter, I love him more today than I did the day I married him, and that's just like not me, but here you are with your help. I've learned how to do that. I sponsor a lot of women in Alcoholics Anonymous, and most of the time I'm grateful for it. Not always, frankly. Actually, I'll tell you about sponsorship. Nobody asked me to sponsor them for a long time. I was 10 years sober before I sponsored anybody that stuck. You know what I mean? People would ask me, and then they'd call me once or maybe never, And I worried about it a lot because all my peers in Alcoholics Anonymous were sponsoring people. And so I'm like, God, does anybody want what I have? Apparently not. So I'm talking to other people and old-timers about it. Nobody's asked. I give my phone number out. Nobody's asked me to sponsor them. So I started praying that God would send me somebody. You got to be so careful about what you pray for. I started praying that God would send me somebody to sponsor. So he did. He sent me this woman who everybody in the group by now had sponsored for a little while. That was kind of my turn in the barrel. And she was the most dreadfully unhappy woman I have ever met in my life. She didn't want to do this. She said, I remember, there was a party or something, an AA party on a, coming up on a Sunday, and she said, "Oh, I can't go." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Because I have headaches on Sunday." So she gets to the party, and it was a pool party, at somebody's house, and so everybody's at Keith's house, and everybody's in the in the pool, and they're doing some kind of, if that's for me, just tell them I'll call them back. Everybody's in the pool doing some kind of a game with a ball, and this girl is sitting on the side of the pool, and he keeps saying to her, come on, it'll be fun. And she's like, no, I don't want to, come on. And she finally said, I have to be here, but I don't have to have a good time. So you kind of get the idea. So now I'm sponsoring this girl, and I really got that I didn't actually want to sponsor anybody. I wanted the part where when they take their cake, how they thank you and say they couldn't have done it without you. That's the part that I wanted. You know, I didn't want to actually like take her calls and worry about her stuff, you know. Once I realized that, I sort of calmed down. And then an old-timer woman said to me, you know, Pat, I've watched you. You give your phone number out to newcomers. And, you know, it's not up to us whether they ask us to sponsor them or not. You're doing what you're supposed to be doing. It'll happen. And eventually it did happen. And I'm grateful that I sponsor these women. Because the thing about sponsoring is, you know, you pretty much have to walk like you talk. You can't be making them do stuff you're not doing, you know. And so it's pretty helpful to me. I could use a Kleenex if anybody has one. Somebody in this room must have one, and they'll leap to their feet any minute with it. Ah! Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Let's see. I was going to talk about my stepfather. Resentments. You know, it says right in our book that resentments are the big deal here. It's the thing we got to get rid of. When I got sober, I had a real resentment. Actually, I didn't see it as a resentment. I saw it as hatred for my stepfather. There was stuff going on in my house that shouldn't have been going on when I was growing up, and I hated him with real good reason. I didn't see it as a problem for today because I don't live there anymore. So, you know, problem's over. But what happened to me is the longer... I did write about it in my inventory. It was one of my big, deep, dark secrets. I wrote about it in my inventory, and you know, it took me longer to get that little paragraph out about that than it did the whole rest of the thing, because I just choked and cried and carried on, so, but I got it out. And my sponsor actually shared back with me something very similar that had occurred in her life, and that took a little of the heat away from it, and I sort of thought that would be it, like, whew, I finally told somebody, thank God that's over, you know? But what happened to me is the longer I stayed sober, the more I kind of thought about it. And the longer I stayed sober, the more it seemed like every speaker who ever got to a podium at every meeting I was at would sort of lean into the microphone, stare directly at me, and say something like, resentments kill alcoholics, especially justifiable resentments. And I'd sit there in my chair sweating and thinking about this, and I think I got to get rid of this resentment. So I started praying, asking God to please remove the resentment. And nothing happened. It is my experience that nothing ever happens if all I'm doing is praying. The way I see the AA program is I ask God for help, and then there is some kind of footwork I'm supposed to be doing. Always there's footwork. And so I ask God for help, and then I talk to my sponsor, always a good idea. And she suggested that I was going to have to make amends to this stepfather. And I said, whoa, wait a minute here. Perhaps you've forgotten my inventory. If any amends should be made here, he should be making them to me. I was a kid. I mean, I have no guilt here. She said, well, let's forget what he did for a moment. Let's look at your teenage years when you were drinking and causing your mother all that grief and anguish and worry that we cause our mothers. She said, your stepfather was living in the house at the same time you were causing your mother all that grief. I had by now long since, you know, had the conversation with my mother. I'm making daily living amends to her. I'm sorry I did those things to my mother. I love my mother. I'm really sorry that I caused her all that trouble. So making amends to my mother is not much of a chore. I hate my stepfather. What do I care if he was a little worried during that time? So what, you know? But again, the book is pretty clear that we got to get rid of these resentments. So reluctantly, and not immediately, I might add, I agreed to go out and have a little chat with him. So I went out there, and he lived about 50 miles away, and I had a little talk with him, and I said, you know, I know that I caused a lot of trouble and worry and anguish and grief and all that while I was when I was living in this house and drinking, and I'm sorry. I know that... you know, I was not a good daughter or stepdaughter here, and I'm going to try to be a better stepdaughter from now on. And I left right away after I said this because I knew if I hung around, I was going to wander off into discussing his shortcomings, and the Big Book is very clear about that. It's, you know, his shortcomings are not my business. And so I kind of spit out what I had to say, and I fled. And I was driving home, and I thought, you know what, these steps don't work. I've made my amends, and I still hate him as much as I ever did. Well, I hadn't actually made the amends. I had made the announcement that the amend was coming. The actual amend is, in fact, being a kind and loving stepdaughter. Oh, my God, when I realized that, I just thought, I can't do it. I cannot do it. I really can't. I got a lot of help from people in AA. I remember a girl that I barely knew said to me, who knew what I was trying to do, said to me in a meeting just before Christmas, she said, you know, a kind and loving daughter wouldn't rush out on Christmas Eve and pick up a tie and have the store wrap it. You know, she might actually put a little thought into what she might be getting as a gift for him. And so I thought about that. I remember I sat on my couch and I said, okay, God, I am willing to get him something that he might like or use or appreciate, but I don't know. You know how some people are just hard to buy for? He really was one of those people. I mean, he didn't have hobbies. And so I said, you know, you're going to have to help me out, God, here with a little inspiration, because I really don't know. I'm willing, but I have no idea what it should be. And I sat on my couch waiting for inspiration to strike, and it didn't. It occurred to me perhaps my footwork was to go to a mall where things are. So I went down to a mall, and I'm walking around the different stores. I went into this needlepoint shop. I did needlepoint in those days. I went into a needlepoint shop, and there was this thing to needlepoint and frame and hang on the wall, a saying about fathers and daughters. Just a sickening, sweet saying about fathers and daughters. I thought, there is no way. But that thing just followed me around the shop. You know what I mean? I just couldn't get away from it. So I bought the damn thing. I took it home. That people who know needlepoint, it takes a lot of time. You know, I did my nicest work. Got framed real nicely. I took it over there, and I gave it to him at Christmas. And there was a moment, just a moment, here and gone that fast, where he got a little tear in his eye when he read that. That little moment kept me going a long time. It really did, you know. I knew in that instant, here and gone, that quickly, that if I kept trying to act as though I were a kind and loving stepdaughter, that somehow God was going to make this resentment bearable enough that I was not going to have to pick up a drink about it. I knew that. I knew it in that instant. I kept trying to do... I remember a couple years later, Vince and I had gone to Yosemite to speak at a conference, and when my mother married my stepfather, I think the first year they were married, or maybe the second year, he took us on a vacation to Yosemite, a camping trip, and it was maybe one of the happiest memories of my childhood. We had a fabulous time. I'd never camped before. We camped and we hiked, and a particular wonderful moment from that trip was we hiked up to Vernal Falls, and I was young. I was like 7 years old or something, and it was too much of a hike for me. You know, I was too little to do it, and it was kind of a strenuous hike, and he had put me on his shoulders, and we were all singing, and it was just this wonderful, happy memory. So we went to the Ansel Adams studio there in the Yosemite, and I bought a picture of Vernal Falls. And I, on the card that accompanied the gift, I wrote essentially what I just said. This is the happiest childhood memory, blah, blah, blah. And I gave it to him, and he loved it. He hung it up right away. Maybe a year later, I was down at their house visiting, and I sat in his chair. You know how everybody has their chair. And on the table by his chair was that card where I'd written that message, and it was completely dog-eared. He must have picked that card up hundreds of times and read it. You know, when he died a number of years ago now, I knew that my amends were made. I grew to love him. I don't know how that happened. It's impossible. You cannot get from where I was to loving him, but I did. And what I feel today when I think about it is I think that he was a sick man, and I think that he was doing the best that he could with the tools he had to work with. I really, honest to God, believe that. I have no resentment, nothing is left about that to torment me. I am so grateful that I was willing to do these things when my best judgment said, oh, this is ridiculous, this is never going to work, you know. My best judgment is terrible. Terrible, you know. Everything good in my life since I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous has been at the suggestion of somebody else, or the strong direction of somebody else, more to the point. I'm so willing so grateful that I've been willing to take direction. Vince and I went into business, after we got married, we went into business for ourselves, and we were making a lot of money, and then he had a heart attack, and the business kind of went in the toilet, and I had to go get a job, and I was really kind of resentful about that. You know, I mean, I worked for him, but not very hard, you know, I didn't want to go get a job. I remember I cried all the way to work that first day. But you know, this is great. I hadn't worked for, like, you know, when you put down that you worked for your husband for 15 years, it doesn't look great on a resume. You know what I mean? They don't believe it. And so I'm thinking, how in the world am I going to get a job? You know? And a woman in AA said to me one night, are you looking for a job? And I said, yes. And she said, we lived in Pasadena, which is a fair distance away from where we go to meetings. And she said, I just took a job as an office manager in Pasadena, and we need a secretary there. You know, I never would have gotten that. I didn't have the kind of experience they wanted. I didn't know computers at the time. And as I say, my resume looked like not true. And she said, I said, well, I don't have the kind of experience you need. And she said, I know you, and I know your work ethic, and I know you can do it. She was only on that job for like 4 months, just long enough for me to get hired there. I'm still on that job today, you know. I love that job. It's great. But anyway, so I went back to work. And then, you know, now I'm working, but Vince was still recovering from heart surgery. His recovery was not quite as speedy as we had hoped, and our business, things were really bad. I wasn't making enough money to support the lifestyle to which we had become accustomed, and we had to sell our house. And I remember feeling so resentful about that. So I remember saying, God, this is so unfair. We, you know, share this house. We've had great AA parties. We've had many AA weddings at that house. This is just not fair that God would take this house away from us. I just, you know. And the last party we had, but we had this, I mean, there was just no question we had to sell, so we put it on the market. The last party that we had there was must have been a 20-year party, 25-year party maybe, for our friend Chuck Nisbet. And it was one of those perfect Southern California days where the sky is clear and you can see the mountains. We live just below the mountains. You can just see the mountains so clear and the air is fresh. We don't get many days like that. That's why I'm sort of going on about it. And it's just a perfect day. And there had been, 300 people in our backyard that day for this party. He was a much-loved man. And the party was winding down. It was late afternoon. Most everybody had gone. I was standing on the back porch looking at the patio, and the people that were left were maybe a dozen or so of our really close and dear friends, Chuck, and I think Clint was still there, and Byron and Marion. And they'd had a bagpiper there earlier in the day, and the bagpiper was walking to his car, and he was, I can hardly talk about this, he was playing Amazing Grace on the bagpipe as he was walking away. I stood there on my porch and I thought, I'm the luckiest woman in the world. You know, it's not about the house. It's about this. It's about the memories. You know, those memories of that, all those parties, all those weddings, everything, those memories are ours forever. You know, it doesn't matter about the house. It just doesn't matter. I'm so grateful that we had that house for the time that we had. I hope we have another house someday, but whatever. You know, we're very happy where we are. Today we live in a little tiny apartment. We moved there because I'm sorry to say we're old enough to live in a senior complex. But we moved there so we could move my 90-year-old mother into the apartment next door to us so we can watch over her. And it's been perfect because there's lots of activities there for her to do. And what a wonderful way to be able to make amends to my mother. You know, I get to take care of her. I get to take her to all her doctor's appointments and to be there for her when she needs me to be there. How blessed am I? You know, I really, if you're new, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope you stay here. This is, if you haven't gathered it by now, the best thing that's ever happened to me. I recommend you do three things if you're new that I think are of equal importance. One is get a sponsor. You don't have to shop around to find just the right sponsor. I get that a lot today. I get people coming up to me. I can tell they're interviewing me. You know? If you're new, how would you know? I mean, you have absolutely no frame of reference. Just ask somebody, you know? The second thing I recommend you do is get a home group, a place where you do bring the cookies or set up the chairs and make the coffee. Make the meeting yours. You know, maybe somebody will miss you if you don't show up and give you a call and maybe save your life. And the third thing I recommend you do is make a friend, somebody around your own length of sobriety you can hang out with and talk to. It's real important, especially when you're new. I had my friend was Betty. I told her everything before I told it to my sponsor. It's nice to hear how stuff's going to sound out loud before you call your sponsor, you know? And so I'd call Betty and I'd say, well, here's what I'm thinking of doing, or worse, here's what I've just done. And sometimes she'd say what I hoped, which is, oh, yeah, me too. But mostly she'd say, oh, God, you better call your sponsor right now. And that's a very good kind of friend to have. And so if you're new, I welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope you stay here. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.